A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. I've just finished listening to the episode about the really weird world of Chinese illicit overseas police stations. This is definitely one that we had to do on My Word Prompts. And MI5 recently released operational footage of two Chinese police officers operating in the UK, trying to coerce somebody out of their apartment for crimes in China. And as you said, probably a large part of the reason that MI5 released this publicly was to signal to China that we know we're watching. This was an operation. But also because it's kind of a weird one from a sovereignty standpoint. It's not a traditional counterintelligence assignment for MI5. We're talking about China operating plainclothes, undisclosed, illegal police stations, policing their own citizens overseas. And that is a very strange phenomenon that just falls between the kind of classic things that law enforcement and intelligence agencies traditionally do. Here's another one that is less illicit and sketchy, but nevertheless, it's something I've wondered. As you know, we live in Jerusalem and travel to the US now and again to see family. And if you've ever flown with an Israeli airline to Israel, whether it's El Al or Israel, you'll probably notice, it's hard not to, that the security is handled by Israeli people. Now, that is in itself a kind of unusual security arrangement. We're talking about airport security being provided by, to some degree, by a sending team from that country, but overseas. And I've often wondered and heard a couple of, you know, murmurs from people who've done the job but haven't really, I'm sure, weren't privy to the actual internal organization, how that actually works, right? You're going through airport security in Frankfurt, but you're boarding a flight to Israel. You're being screened at the boarding gate by someone who might be working with the airline enforcing their own security. But ultimately, it's German police who are managing the actual airport security. And there's a reason why I mentioned Germany, because of the history, I guess. The security in Germany is extreme, to put it mildly. But in general, if you're traveling to Israel, the security is not, it's your typical airport security that everyone goes through, plus usually an additional layer. We're talking usually a boarding gate used exclusively for Israel, an additional pre-boarding scan in addition to the one you've already done. So the traditional rules, like you're airside, you're clear, you're done, have a beer, wait for the boarding call, kind of go out the window. It's a bit more stressful, I would say. And there's often a terrible lack of vending machines at the Israeli gates. So you need to remember that if you are flying El Al to Israel, make sure to, have those beers and the airport food, do that stuff before you get to the sterile zone for Israel. Now, I don't know if there's other airlines that do something similar. Israel's kind of an extreme case in point, and El Al is world famous for its security. But in arrangements like this, where you've got some degree of what seems like a country operating its own security mechanism, but on foreign soil, we could talk about the security of embassies, which happens all over the world. We've kind of covered aspects of this, like an embassy isn't really a foreign country. But I'd love to know a little bit or understand a bit more about how this actually works in airport security. I presume an airline like El Al or Lufthansa can't just show up at an airport and say, we're doing security for our flights, right? I assume that there has to be some element of control from the operating body and from the host country. But I wonder as to how that process actually works. See if you can find Herman and Corin. This will be a challenging one for your research abilities. Any information about this and these kind of unusual but not altogether uncommon arrangements.
Daniel sent us this one after listening to our episode on Chinese overseas police stations, and he's connecting it to something a lot of people who fly to Israel have experienced but probably never thought about in sovereignty terms. He's asking about those Israeli security agents you see at foreign airports, the ones screening passengers at the gate for El Al or Israel flights. How does that actually work legally? You're standing in Frankfurt or Newark, but you're being questioned by someone who's clearly operating under Israeli authority. Daniel wants to know what kind of agreements make that possible, whether it's unique to Israel, and how the jurisdictional lines get drawn when one country's security apparatus operates on another country's soil.
This is one of those things where once you notice it, you can't unnotice it. Your airside, you've passed through German or American security, you think you're done. And suddenly there's another checkpoint, often a separate cordoned-off gate area, and the people running it are not locals, they're Israeli. They're asking questions that feel more like an interview than a security scan. Where did you pack your bags? Who gave you anything to carry? Why were you in this city? What's your connection to Israel?
I love how Daniel slipped in the practical tip about the vending machines. He's not wrong. The Israeli gate zones are famously barren. You're trapped in what feels like a diplomatic no-man's land with no snacks and a very serious person asking about your grandmother's maiden name.
The vending machine observation is oddly specific and entirely accurate, but the legal question underneath it is genuinely fascinating. And by the way, DeepSeek V4 Pro is writing our script today, so if anything comes out particularly coherent, that's why.
So let's dig into the actual framework. What makes it possible for El Al security agents to operate in Frankfurt, in Paris, in Newark?
The key document in almost every case is a bilateral aviation security agreement between Israel and the host country. These aren't publicly available in full detail for obvious security reasons, but the framework is well understood. Under the Chicago Convention of 1944, which governs international civil aviation, every country has the right to set security requirements for flights entering its airspace. The state of the operator, the country where the airline is registered, can impose additional security measures. But here's the crucial part. Those measures have to be negotiated with the host state where the airport is located.
It's not that El Al just shows up and sets up shop. There's a treaty-level agreement saying, effectively, Germany permits Israel to conduct supplementary screening at German airports for flights bound for Tel Aviv under agreed-upon parameters.
And the agreements typically specify what Israeli security personnel can and cannot do. They can question passengers, conduct additional physical screening of carry-on items, use specialized equipment, but they don't have arrest powers. They can't detain anyone. If an Israeli security agent in Frankfurt determines that a passenger poses a threat, they have to call in German federal police, the Bundespolizei, to actually take any enforcement action.
Which creates a fascinating split. The screening authority is Israeli, but the coercive power remains entirely with the host state. It's like they're operating with borrowed sovereignty.
Borrowed sovereignty is a good way to put it, and it's not unique to Israel, though Israel's version is probably the most visible and extensive. The United States has federal air marshals on certain international routes, and after 9/11, the TSA stationed inspectors at some foreign airports with host country permission. But those arrangements tend to be less passenger-facing than what Israel does.
What about U Customs and Border Protection pre-clearance facilities? You go through U Customs in Shannon or Abu Dhabi or Vancouver before you even board the plane.
Right. And pre-clearance is a useful comparison because the legal mechanism is more transparent. Those are governed by specific bilateral treaties, and CBP officers at pre-clearance facilities do have limited enforcement powers on foreign soil, including the authority to detain and question. But even there, the host country retains ultimate jurisdiction. A CBP officer in Toronto can't arrest a Canadian citizen for violating Canadian law. The pre-clearance agreement strictly limits their authority to U Customs and immigration enforcement.
The Israeli model is different because it's not customs or immigration. It's pure security screening. The agents aren't determining admissibility to Israel. That happens on arrival at Ben Gurion. They're determining whether you're safe to board the aircraft.
That distinction matters legally. Under most bilateral agreements, the airline has a responsibility to ensure the safety of its flights. The Tokyo Convention of 1963, the Montreal Convention, and various ICAO annexes all reinforce that the aircraft commander and the airline have security obligations. So when LL places security agents at a foreign gate, they're technically operating as an extension of the airline's security responsibility under international law, not as agents of the Israeli government exercising sovereign power abroad.
Although in practice, many of those agents are former Shin Bet or IDF intelligence personnel, the line between airline security and state security is blurry at best.
Oh, it's completely blurred. LL's security division works in extremely close coordination with the Israel Security Agency, the Shin Bet. The agents at foreign airports may be employed by the airline on paper, but their training, their threat assessments, their operational protocols all come from the Israeli intelligence community. The host country knows this. Everyone knows this. But the legal fiction of airline-employed security contractors makes the arrangement diplomatically palatable.
The host country can say, "We're not allowing a foreign intelligence service to operate on our soil. We're simply allowing an airline to fulfill its international security obligations using its own trained personnel."
And that fiction holds up reasonably well. Germany, for example, has been quite accommodating of LL's security arrangements. Part of that is the historical relationship. Part of it is that German authorities recognize that Israel faces a unique threat environment and that LL's security protocols are effective.
Let's talk about what makes those protocols different. What's actually happening that's distinct from standard airport security?
The Israeli approach is fundamentally behavioral and intelligence driven, whereas most airport security globally is threat object driven. Standard TSA or European airport security is looking for weapons, explosives, prohibited items. The Israeli model starts from the assumption that the person is more important than the object. The questioning is designed to detect anomalies in behavior, in story, in travel patterns.
Let's not pretend they don't.
They absolutely profile, but it's not crude demographic profiling. Israeli security uses what's sometimes called predictive profiling or behavioral profiling. They're looking at your travel itinerary, your ticket purchase pattern, your answers to seemingly innocuous questions, your body language, micro-expressions. The agent isn't just listening to what you say, they're watching how you say it, what you do with your hands, whether your story holds up under slight variations in questioning.
The famous question is, where did you pack your bags? And then 10 minutes later, after talking about other things, they circle back and ask, and who helped you pack? If you hesitate or give a different answer, that's a red flag.
That's precisely why they need their own personnel, not local security contractors. The questioning requires language skills, cultural knowledge, an understanding of Israeli society, and travel patterns that a German or American security officer simply wouldn't have. An Israeli agent knows what a typical Israeli backpacker's itinerary through Southeast Asia looks like. They know which answers are normal for someone visiting family in Haifa versus someone who claims to be a tourist but can't name a single hotel.
There's also the intelligence dimension that the passenger never sees. Before you even arrive at the airport, your name has been run through Israeli security databases. LL and the Shin Bet maintain watch lists and threat assessments updated in real time. If you're flagged before you even check in, the questioning at the gate is not really an assessment, it's a confirmation.
This gets us to the jurisdictional tension Daniel was asking about. What happens when Israeli security flags someone at a foreign airport? The host country has its own sovereignty, its own laws about what constitutes grounds for denying boarding. A German citizen cannot be denied the right to travel based solely on Israeli security concerns, at least not without German authorities concurring.
In practice, if LL decides you're not getting on the plane, you're not getting on the plane. The airline has the right to refuse carriage under its conditions of carriage. You signed that when you bought the ticket.
That's the contractual workaround. The airline isn't deporting you or detaining you. It's simply declining to provide you with the service. You're free to book another flight, free to leave the airport. The host country's sovereignty isn't technically violated because no state action has been taken against you. A private company has made a commercial decision.
Though we both know it's not really a commercial decision. It's a security determination made with state intelligence input, executed by personnel with deep ties to the intelligence services under a bilateral framework that the host country has approved. The whole thing is a carefully constructed legal edifice designed to maximize security while minimizing sovereignty friction.
Let me give you a concrete example. In 2012, there was a significant controversy when El Al security procedures at Heathrow were challenged. Passengers described intrusive questioning, and there were allegations of ethnic profiling. The UK Department for Transport had to clarify the legal basis. They pointed to a memorandum of understanding between the UK and Israel that specifically authorized El Al to conduct supplementary security measures, subject to oversight by the UK Department for Transport and compliance with UK anti-discrimination law.
The host country retains regulatory oversight. The Israelis can't just do whatever they want.
And that's the critical balance. The Israeli security personnel operate under the host country's legal framework, not Israeli law. If a German passenger files a complaint about questioning at the El Al gate in Frankfurt, that complaint goes to German authorities and is adjudicated under German law. The Israeli agents have no immunity, no diplomatic status, no special legal protections.
Which raises an interesting question. If one of these agents were to physically restrain someone, even briefly, could they be prosecuted for assault under local law?
Almost certainly, yes, and that's why they don't do it. The protocols are extremely clear. Physical contact is avoided at all costs. If a passenger becomes aggressive, the Israeli agents step back and call local law enforcement. They're trained to de-escalate and report, never to engage physically.
This is where the comparison to embassy security that Daniel mentioned becomes interesting. An embassy has formal diplomatic status under the Vienna Convention. The grounds are inviolable. The security personnel may have diplomatic immunity. The airport arrangement has none of those protections. It's much more precarious, legally speaking.
An embassy marine security guard or a diplomatic security service agent operates under a completely different legal framework. They have status, they have immunities, they're accredited to the host government. The El Al security agent at the gate is, legally speaking, a private contractor working for an airline. The host country can revoke their permission to operate at any time. There's no treaty obligation to allow them to stay.
Which makes the whole arrangement surprisingly fragile. If a host country decided tomorrow that it no longer wanted Israeli security personnel operating on its soil, it could simply notify the airline that the supplementary screening arrangement is terminated. The flights could still operate. They'd just have to rely on standard airport security.
That's happened, actually. Not with Israel, but with other countries' aviation security arrangements. After certain diplomatic incidents, host countries have withdrawn permissions for foreign security personnel. The flights continue, but the security posture changes.
Let's talk about Germany specifically, since Daniel mentioned it. Why is German airport security, as he put it, extreme?
Germany has a particularly intense airport security culture, partly for historical reasons, partly because of specific threat experiences. The Bundespolizei has a very robust aviation security division, armed, highly trained, conducting random patrols in terminals. But more relevant to our topic, Germany has been one of the most accommodating countries for El Al's security arrangements. There's a long-standing bilateral aviation security agreement, and German authorities have consistently supported the supplementary screening model.
The historical dimension there is hard to ignore. Germany's willingness to accommodate Israeli security concerns on German soil carries a certain weight.
And it's not just Germany. France, the Netherlands, Italy, any country with direct El Al flights has negotiated some version of this framework. The specifics vary. Some countries allow Israeli agents to be armed. That's rare, and usually requires a separate diplomatic note. Most don't. Some require a local law enforcement officer to be present at the Israeli screening point at all times. Some require that the Israeli agents be accompanied by local security personnel.
What about the United States?
Arrangement is particularly interesting because it's multi-layered. El Al operates out of JFK, Newark, LAX, Miami. The supplementary screening is conducted under a security agreement between Israel and the TSA. But there's an additional layer, the FF. B, I, and the Department of Homeland Security have their own threat assessments and intelligence sharing with Israel. So by the time a passenger reaches the El Al gate at Newark, their information has potentially been reviewed by both U and Israeli security systems.
Also has its own preclearance model, which creates a kind of reciprocal dynamic. Israel allows U preclearance at Ben-Gurion for flights to the U, and the U allows Israeli supplementary screening at American airports for flights to Israel. It's not exactly symmetrical, but there's a mutual recognition of security needs.
That reciprocity is a key diplomatic principle underlying all of these arrangements. The host country is not just doing Israel a favor, it's recognizing that Israeli security screening reduces the risk to the host country's own airport. If a threat manages to board an LL flight in Frankfurt and that flight is destroyed or hijacked, the incident happens in or near German airspace. The host country has a vested interest in Israeli security being effective.
It's not altruism. It's enlightened self-interest wrapped in a bilateral agreement.
And that's true of most international security cooperation. Countries don't share intelligence or allow foreign security operations out of goodwill. They do it because the alternative, a successful attack, is worse for everyone.
Let's circle back to something Daniel mentioned at the start. He connected this to the Chinese overseas police station phenomenon. What's the difference, legally speaking?
The difference is fundamental and instructive. The Chinese overseas police stations were not disclosed to host governments. They were not authorized. They were not operating under any bilateral agreement. They were clandestine. Chinese officials were conducting what amounted to law enforcement actions against Chinese citizens without the knowledge or consent of the host country. That's a sovereignty violation, plain and simple.
Whereas the LL arrangement is entirely above board. The host government knows who the agents are, what they're doing, where they're operating, and under what constraints. There's a signed agreement. There's regulatory oversight. The agents don't have enforcement powers.
Transparency and consent are the dividing line. And this is why the MI5 footage of Chinese officers in the UK was such a big deal. MI5 was documenting a sovereignty violation and signaling that it was aware and watching. That's a counterintelligence operation. The LL security arrangement isn't counterintelligence. It's cooperative security under international civil aviation law.
There's an interesting gray zone. What about countries that don't have formal bilateral agreements but still allow Israeli security personnel to operate? I've heard that in some locations, the arrangement is less formal. Maybe just a letter of understanding between the airline and the local airport authority.
That's harder to verify, but it almost certainly happens, especially where LL operates seasonal or charter flights. In those cases, the legal basis might be thinner. The airline negotiates directly with the airport operator. The airport operator checks with its national aviation authority, and some kind of ad hoc permission is granted. The security personnel might be classified as airline staff rather than security contractors. The host country might not even be fully aware of the specifics.
Which is legally riskier for the agents involved. If something goes wrong, they don't have the protections of a formal bilateral agreement to fall back on.
That's probably why Israel prefers to operate in countries where there's a robust bilateral framework. The major European destinations, the EU, Canada, these all have formal agreements. The riskier deployments are in countries with less developed legal systems or less stable diplomatic relationships.
Let's talk about the passenger experience for a moment. Why is the Israeli gate area so often separated from the rest of the terminal? Why the cordoned off zone?
It's partly security and partly logistics. From a security standpoint, creating a sterile zone around the gate allows the Israeli agents to control access more effectively. Once you're in that zone, you've been screened by them, and they know who's there. Anyone approaching who hasn't been through the supplementary screening is immediately identifiable. It also prevents someone from handing a passenger a prohibited item after they've been screened but before they board. LL often uses aircraft that board via stairs rather than jet bridges in some airports, which requires a different gate configuration. But more importantly, the separate zone allows the security team to conduct secondary screening, baggage reconciliation, and document checks without disrupting the flow of other airport operations.
Daniel mentioned the lack of vending machines in these zones. I suspect that's not a security feature. It's just that nobody's thought to put vending machines in a temporary sterile area that only operates for a few hours a day.
It's almost certainly just an oversight of airport retail planning. But it does create this strange experience where you're in a liminal space. You've left the host country's commercial airport environment, but you haven't yet entered the Israeli security environment. You're in a kind of jurisdictional waiting room.
With no snacks.
With no snacks. It's a humanitarian concern, really.
Let's get into the specifics of what these bilateral agreements typically contain. What do we know from the ones that have been partially disclosed or discussed in academic literature?
The most detailed public analysis comes from aviation security law journals and ICAO working papers. The agreements typically cover several key areas. First, the scope of permitted activities. Second, the legal status of the personnel, usually classified as airline staff or private security contractors, not government agents. Third, the chain of command. Fourth, the use of force, almost always prohibited or severely restricted. Fifth, information sharing between the security team and host country authorities. Sixth, liability and insurance. Who's responsible if something goes wrong?
The liability question is interesting. If an Israeli security agent harms someone or damages property at a foreign airport, who pays?
That's negotiated case by case, but typically the airline carries insurance that covers the activities of its security personnel. The host country may require proof of insurance as a condition of the agreement. In some cases, the agreement includes a waiver of sovereign immunity, meaning Israel as a state can't be sued in the host country's courts, but the airline and its employees can be.
Which again underscores how carefully this is structured to avoid sovereignty conflicts. The state of Israel isn't formally present. The airline is present, and the airline is subject to local law.
That's the genius of the arrangement from a diplomatic standpoint. Israel gets effective security screening conducted by its own trained personnel using its own intelligence and methodology. The host country gets the security benefit without ceding any actual sovereignty. The legal friction is managed through corporate liability and insurance rather than through diplomatic immunity or treaty obligations.
What about countries that don't have diplomatic relations with Israel? Can El Al still operate and conduct security screening there?
That's much more complicated. El Al doesn't fly to countries that don't recognize Israel, with very few exceptions. When it does, for example, charter flights or special diplomatic missions, the security arrangements are negotiated through third parties, often with the involvement of a neutral country's embassy. The security personnel might operate under different cover, with different legal protections. It's much riskier.
I'm curious about the reciprocity angle. Do any other countries station their own security personnel at Ben Gurion Airport for flights to their countries?
Yes, to varying degrees. Carriers operating out of Ben Gurion have access to TSA-approved security procedures, and there are U.S. security personnel involved in screening for flights to the United States under the pre-clearance model. Some European countries have their own security liaison officers at Ben Gurion, though they're usually less visible than the Israeli agents abroad. The asymmetry is notable. Israel's security footprint at foreign airports is larger and more passenger-facing than what other countries do in Israel.
Which makes sense given the threat environment. Israel faces threats that most other countries don't, at least not at the same scale or intensity.
El Al has been the target of multiple attempted attacks over the decades. The 1960s and 70s saw a wave of hijackings and attempted bombings targeting Israeli aviation. The current security protocols are the product of decades of hard experience.
There's a broader point here about how international law accommodates security needs without formally surrendering sovereignty. The El Al model is one example. Preclearance model is another. Embassy security is a third. In each case, there's a carefully calibrated agreement that allows foreign security personnel to operate on host soil, but with strict limitations and under host country oversight.
The trend is toward more such arrangements, not fewer. As threats become more transnational, the old model of strictly territorial security, we handle everything on our soil, you handle everything on yours, is breaking down. Countries are recognizing that effective security requires a presence at the point of origin, not just the point of arrival.
The pre-clearance example is instructive. When CBP officers screen passengers in Abu Dhabi or Shannon, they're extending the U. The legal fiction is that you haven't entered the United States, but for customs and immigration purposes, you're being treated as if you have. The same logic applies to Israeli security screening. The security perimeter extends outward to the point of departure.
This raises interesting questions about where sovereignty actually resides in the modern aviation system. If you're an Israeli citizen flying from Frankfurt to Tel Aviv, you're subject to German law at the airport, Israeli security screening at the gate, and Israeli law on the aircraft. You're moving through multiple jurisdictional layers in a single journey.
The aircraft itself is Israeli territory under international law once the doors close, at least for purposes of criminal jurisdiction under the Tokyo Convention. So in a single trip, you might be subject to 4 different legal regimes. The country you departed from, the security screening country, the aircraft's state of registration, and the destination country.
That's before we even get into the complications of overflight. If the aircraft flies over a third country, that country's airspace sovereignty applies. It's a jurisdictional layer cake.
Let's bring this back to Daniel's original question about how these arrangements get set up. What's the actual process? Who initiates it?
Typically, the airline initiates. LL wants to start service to a new destination, or wants to maintain service with its standard security protocols. The airline approaches the Israeli Ministry of Transport, which coordinates with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Shin Bet. The foreign ministry then approaches the host country's government. A negotiation begins, often at the level of aviation security officials rather than diplomats.
It's technical before it's political.
The aviation security experts from both sides work out the operational details. How many agents? What screening procedures? Where will they be stationed? Once the technical details are agreed, the political level signs off, and a memorandum of understanding or a formal bilateral agreement is executed.
If the host country says no?
Then El Al has a choice. It can operate without the supplementary screening, relying entirely on host country security, which it has done in some cases, though it's uncommon. Or it can decide not to operate the route. There are destinations that El Al doesn't serve specifically because the security arrangements couldn't be negotiated to Israel's satisfaction.
What about countries where the security situation changes after the agreement is in place? Can Israel unilaterally adjust its security posture?
The agreements typically include consultation mechanisms for exactly that scenario. If the threat environment changes, Israel can request modifications. The host country can agree, negotiate, or refuse. In an extreme case, Israel might decide that the host country's security is no longer adequate and suspend flights. That's happened before.
I want to touch on something Daniel mentioned about the boarding gate being used exclusively for Israel. That's not just about the supplementary screening. There's also a practical consideration around aircraft security on the ground.
El Al aircraft are guarded while on the ground at foreign airports. Baggage is reconciled. Every checked bag is matched to a passenger on board before departure. Cargo is screened. Catering is supervised. The separate gate area makes it easier to maintain that security cordon around the aircraft.
The catering supervision is a whole other layer. El Al has its own kosher catering requirements, but the security dimension is also significant. The catering trucks, the food, the personnel who load the meals, all of that is a potential vulnerability.
The history of aviation attacks includes attempts to introduce explosives through catering supplies, through cargo, through ground service equipment. El Al's security model treats the entire ground operation as a potential attack vector, not just the passenger screening checkpoint.
Which is why the security presence at foreign airports is more than just the agents at the gate. There are people watching the aircraft, watching the baggage handling, watching the catering. It's a comprehensive security operation.
The host country has to agree to all of it. The Israeli security personnel need access to areas of the airport that are normally restricted, the ramp, baggage handling areas. All of that requires host country permission and coordination with the airport operator.
The agreement isn't just about screening passengers at the gate. It's about embedding Israeli security personnel throughout the airport's operations for the duration of the aircraft's ground time.
And that's why these agreements are so detailed and why they take time to negotiate. The host country is giving a foreign entity access to sensitive areas of its airport infrastructure. That's not something any country does lightly.
Let's talk about a specific case that illustrates the tensions here. In the 1980s, there was an incident at Heathrow where an El Al security agent discovered a bomb in the luggage of a passenger. The passenger, Anne Marie Murphy, was an Irish woman who had been given the bag by her Jordanian fiancé, Nezar Hindawi. The bomb was planted without her knowledge. The El Al agent detected it during questioning and screening.
The Hindawi affair. That's a textbook case of why the Israeli model works. Standard airport security at the time might not have caught it. The bag itself didn't contain anything obviously prohibited. It was a sophisticated device hidden in the lining. But the questioning revealed inconsistencies in Murphy's story. The agent noticed she seemed confused about who had packed the bag, about her travel plans, about her fiancé. The behavioral profiling flagged her for additional scrutiny, and the device was found.
That happened at a foreign airport, under the bilateral security agreement between the UK and Israel. The agent was operating under UK legal oversight, on UK soil, screening a passenger who was an Irish citizen flying on an Israeli airline. The jurisdictional complexity of that moment is staggering.
It all worked. The agent identified the threat, the device was secured, the passenger was handed over to British authorities, and Hindawi was eventually convicted and sentenced to 45 years. It's the strongest possible argument for why Israel insists on its own security personnel at foreign airports.
It also highlights the dependency. If the UK had not agreed to the supplementary screening arrangement, or if it had imposed restrictions that prevented the kind of questioning that caught Murphy, the outcome might have been different.
That's the constant tension in these negotiations. Israel wants maximum operational freedom for its security personnel. The host country wants to maintain sovereignty and legal oversight. The agreement has to balance both.
Let's pivot slightly to something Daniel hinted at, the stress factor for passengers. He described the Israeli gate experience as more stressful than standard airport security. Is that inherent to the model, or is it a cultural thing?
It's partly inherent and partly cultural. The questioning is designed to be somewhat unsettling. It's meant to disrupt rehearsed answers, to catch inconsistencies. A polite superficial screening is less effective at detecting deception. So, there's an intentional edge to the interaction that passengers pick up on.
The Israeli cultural style doesn't help. Israeli security agents are not known for their warm, fuzzy customer service approach. They're direct, they're intense, they ask personal questions without apology. For passengers who aren't used to that, it can feel aggressive.
There's also the asymmetry of information. The agent knows things about you that you don't know. They know. They've run your name through databases. They've reviewed your travel history. They may have intelligence about your seatmate, your employer, your country of origin. You're standing there thinking you're just answering questions about your vacation, but the agent is cross-referencing your answers against a threat matrix you can't see.
That's unsettling by design. The passenger is at an information disadvantage, and that creates a psychological dynamic that the screening exploits.
To be fair, most passengers pass through without incident. The questioning is usually brief, 5 minutes, maybe 10. It's only when something triggers additional scrutiny that it becomes prolonged. But the anticipation of that scrutiny, the uncertainty about what they might ask, is what Daniel is describing as stressful.
The vending machine thing, though, that's just poor planning. There's no security rationale for denying people snacks.
I think we've established that the vending machine gap is a market failure, not a security feature. Someone should address it. Perhaps a listener with connections in airport retail.
Let's broaden the lens. Are there other airlines that operate similar supplementary screening arrangements?
Several Middle Eastern carriers have enhanced security arrangements at foreign airports. Emirates, Etihad, Qatar Airways, but those tend to be less passenger-facing. They involve behind-the-scenes coordination with host country security rather than separate screening checkpoints manned by the airline's own personnel.
What about you? After 9/11, there was talk of you airlines establishing their own security screening at foreign airports.
That was discussed but largely abandoned in favor of the TSA's Foreign Airport Assessment Program. Instead of stationing you screeners abroad, the TSA audits foreign airport security and requires host countries to meet EU standards for flights bound for the United States. It's a different model, regulatory rather than operational.
The Israeli model of actually stationing your own people at foreign gates is relatively unusual in its directness.
And that directness is a function of Israel's unique threat environment and its relatively small aviation footprint. El Al operates a limited number of routes from a limited number of foreign airports. It's feasible to station trained personnel at all of them. A carrier like United or Lufthansa operates hundreds of routes from dozens of countries. That model wouldn't scale.
The Israeli approach is possible precisely because the network is small enough to secure comprehensively.
And the threat level justifies the expense. El Al's security budget is substantial, and it's subsidized by the Israeli government. The airline couldn't afford it on a purely commercial basis.
Which brings us to the question of who pays. The bilateral agreements typically don't involve the host country paying for Israeli security. The cost is borne by Israel, either through the airline or through direct government funding.
The host country provides access and oversight, but the personnel, equipment, and operations are funded by Israel. In some cases, the host country may charge fees for the use of airport facilities, but the security operation itself is an Israeli expense.
The host country is getting a security benefit at no direct cost. That's part of why these agreements are politically sustainable.
The host country also gets intelligence sharing as part of the deal. Israeli security agencies share threat information with their counterparts in countries where El Al operates. That intelligence flow is valuable, and it's part of what makes the arrangement attractive to host governments.
Let's talk about the future of this model. As aviation security technology evolves, biometric screening, AI-powered threat detection, advanced imaging, does the Israeli model of human-centered behavioral profiling become less relevant?
I'd argue the opposite. The technology is getting better at detecting objects, but it's still not great at detecting hostile intent. A sophisticated adversary can defeat object-based screening by using novel materials, by exploiting gaps in the technology, by recruiting clean-skinned operatives with no prior record. The human element, the questioning, the behavioral assessment, remains critical precisely because it targets intent rather than objects.
The technology can augment the human screening rather than replace it. An agent with access to real-time biometric analysis, to AI-flagged travel anomalies, to networked intelligence databases, is more effective than an agent working from memory and a clipboard.
That's already happening. Israeli security screening incorporates advanced technology alongside the human questioning. The databases are sophisticated. The watch lists are dynamically updated. But the core methodology, person-to-person questioning by a trained, culturally knowledgeable agent, remains central.
There's also a deterrence dimension. The visible security presence at the gate signals to potential adversaries that this is not a soft target. The questioning itself is a screening mechanism, but the fact that questioning happens is also a deterrent.
Security theater gets a bad rap, but visible, credible security measures do have deterrent value. The El Al gate area, with its separate screening and its intense questioning, communicates that this flight is being protected by people who know what they're doing. A would-be attacker might look at that and decide to try a different target.
That's a public good for the host airport as well. An attack on an El Al flight at Frankfurt doesn't just kill the people on board. It disrupts the entire airport, causes economic damage, undermines public confidence in aviation security generally. The host country benefits from the deterrence effect, even if it never has to respond to an actual incident.
Which circles back to the enlightened self-interest point. These arrangements persist because they work for everyone involved. Israel gets security. The host country gets security and intelligence. Passengers get to fly. The only losers are the people who want to do harm, and the passengers who forgot to buy snacks before entering the sterile zone.
The snackless passengers are the forgotten victims of international aviation security.
Someone should write a think piece.
Daniel's prompt also mentioned embassy security as a parallel. We've covered that ground before, but it's worth noting the key distinction. Embassy security operates under diplomatic law. The Vienna Convention gives the sending state the right to protect its mission. Airport security arrangements are much thinner, legally speaking.
Embassy security personnel often have diplomatic status. Marine security guards at EU embassies, for example, are accredited as administrative and technical staff under the Vienna Convention. They have certain immunities. The El Al security agent at the gate has none of that. They're a private contractor subject to local criminal and civil law.
Which makes the airport arrangement more fragile, but also less politically contentious. A host country can terminate an airport security agreement without triggering a diplomatic crisis. Kicking out embassy security personnel is a much bigger deal.
That fragility is manageable because the arrangement is mutually beneficial. As long as both sides perceive a net benefit, the agreement holds. If the benefit calculus changes, the agreement can be terminated relatively cleanly.
Let's wrap up with a forward-looking thought. As geopolitical tensions shift, as new threats emerge, as aviation technology changes, do you see this model spreading to more airlines and more countries, or is it a unique artifact of Israel's specific circumstances?
I think we'll see elements of it spread, but not the full Israeli model. The trend is toward intelligence-driven, risk-based screening rather than one-size-fits-all checkpoint security. Countries will want more control over who boards flights to their territory. That could mean more bilateral agreements, more information sharing, more targeted screening at foreign airports. But the comprehensive, personnel-intensive Israeli approach is probably too expensive and too politically complex for most countries to replicate at scale.
Israel remains the outlier, the country that decided the only way to secure its aviation is to extend its security perimeter to every departure gate, everywhere its airlines fly. And the world has accommodated that, partly out of recognition of the genuine threat, partly out of self-interest, and partly because the legal scaffolding is clever enough to make it.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.